Straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. You're listening to the Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again. This is Jay Shapiro. Thanks for listening. Before I provide the listeners with a short review of the program, I want to take note of something that occurred this week that got a lot of headlines here in Israel. Ben & Jerry's ice cream is very popular here, and they have a plant here in the town of Yavne, which is not far from Ashdod along the coast. My wife and I are great admirers of the ice cream, and we always have a supply of a flavor called Cherry Garcia in our freezer. The main office in the United States announced that it will boycott West Bank settlements and Jewish neighborhoods in East Jerusalem by refusing to allow its products to be sold in those areas. The announcement was rebuffed by the Ben & Jerry Israel branch. It said it would continue to sell in all of Israel. The local contract ends in about a year and a half, so we'll have to see how this works out. I would hate to give up Cherry Garcia, but I may have to for patriotic reasons. As far as today's show is concerned, I speak about the various organizations that claim to represent the Jews of America, like the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations, the Israel Public Affairs Committee, J Street, and Hayas, and of course the Zionist Organization of America. I'm not an expert what these organizations do, but I try to review whom they claim to represent as I see it. And I discussed the reaction of the Islamic nations to the visit of several hundred Jews to the Temple Mount on the Memorial Day of the 9th of Av, and in particular the negative response of an Arab party that's part of the coalition that is now governing in Israel. I can only say a few words about this very important subject, but it is something that must be brought to the attention of the listeners. Again, thanks for listening. I'll be back after the break.
The return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel was prophesied in the Bible thousands of years ago and is coming true today. Shalom. Join me, Josh Wander, on Israel Unplugged. Listen in as we delve into the spiritual and physical aspects of the Jewish return to Zion. We'll discuss the biblically mandated, historic, and of course practical understandings of this incredible transition from exile to redemption. That's Israel Unplugged, every Monday on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again. I want to say a few words about the organized Jewish community as I understand it. There are a plethora of groups claiming to represent American Jews. The notion that any single organization could represent the views or the interests of American Jews, particularly on Israel or in any other issue, has always been sort of laughable. Yet this dubious assertion has been the raison d'etre of one of the more successful experiments in political activism in American Jewish history. Born 7 decades ago out of a hostile administration's impatience with the Jewish groups lobbying the State Department about Israel, the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organization came into existence and has thrived by claiming to be the central address for American Jewish political interests. Malcolm Hohenheim, who became the executive vice president in 1986, retired a couple of years ago, was a good friend of mine from Philadelphia. But while the conference has enjoyed a unique position in the organized Jewish world, many of the groups who compose its membership are neither major in any real sense or by themselves particularly influential, let alone representative of American Jewry. Nor can it be considered the public face of the pro-Israel community. That distinction, the public face of the pro-Israel community, belongs to the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, known by its initials AIPAC. Unlike AIPAC, the conference can't mobilize tens of thousands of activists to lobby Congress or attend an annual conference or help direct campaigns donations to Friends of Israel or enemies of the Jewish state. Despite its title, the conference has lacked the ability to command the member groups to take action or even the most simple issues. There are 53 organizations belonging to the conference. They retain complete autonomy of action, and they are also divided along political and ideological lines that allow little room for cooperation. The conference was created in response to the dilemma of how Jews could best address an unfriendly administration in Washington. Back in 1952, Dwight Eisenhower was elected, and it created a situation in which Jewish groups found themselves stymied in their attempts to lobby a State Department and White House that had little patience for the plethora of organizations seeking to bend their ears. Secretary of State at that time, John Forster Dulles, particularly indignant about being asked to listen to the opinion of an array of groups claiming to speak for the pro-Israel or Jewish communities. His advice was for the Jews to band together, form a single group, or face the possibility that none of them would get a hearing. So what happened was, in 1953, an informal gathering of top Jewish leaders of groups such as the American Jewish Committee, the B'nai B'rith, the World Jewish Congress, and the Zionist Organization of America became known as the President's Club. In 1956, and when Eisenhower was reelected, and Eisenhower and Dulles came down hard on the Israeli government because of their opposition to the Sinai campaign, Israel undertook with Britain and France against the Egyptians. The need to formalize Jewish advocacy became urgent, and the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organization was born. In the years that followed, the conference served a useful purpose by giving substance to what was, in the wake of a wave of pro-Israel sentiment that swept over American Jewry in response to the aftermath of the Holocaust, the 1967 Six-Day War, and the 1973 Yom Kippur War, there was a general consensus in America that regarded the Jewish state's survival as a communal priority. The plight of the Jews trapped inside the former Soviet Union also rallied American Jews. In the 1980s, when AIPAC began to concentrate its energies on lobbying Congress, while the conference devoted itself to be heard by the executive branch, widespread support for the alliance between the two democracies finally reflected a larger bipartisan consensus. In other words, Israel and the U.S. were essentially going in the same direction. But the source of the conference's success in leading Jewish activism on behalf of both Israel and the crusade to free Soviet Jewry The notion that there is such a thing as a Jewish consensus always threatened its undoing. The idea that an embattled Israel had the backing of the overwhelming majority of American Jewry in its battle for survival was probably true during the period stretching from the 1948 War of Independence to the Lebanon War of 1982. But the enthusiasm for Israel during this period veiled what was pretty much a basic truth about American Jewry's historic ambivalence about the idea of a Jewish state that had largely prevailed before 1948. There were people who did not think there should be a Jewish state. As the memory of the Holocaust faded and Israel grew stronger in its defense of itself, passionate involvement and sympathy for Israel began to weaken within the American Jewish community. The overwhelming majority of American Jewry was religiously non-Orthodox and believed the universalist strain within Judaism to be its most authentic expression. This idea was challenged by Israel's particularism and increasing religiosity. The conference's standing as a group that embraced all segments of the community helped sidetrack dissatisfaction with its pro-Israel consensus. Even so, liberal Americans became increasingly disillusioned by the more hard-boiled views about the Palestinians articulated by elected Israeli leaders who were skeptical about prospects for peace with the Palestinians. And the gap between Israel and the United States Jewry widened following the collapse of the Oslo process after Yasser Arafat rejected peace at Camp David in 2000 and followed that up with the terrorist war of attrition called the Second Intifada. That the conference still held together throughout this period was due to the leadership of my friend Malcolm Homeline and his ability to recruit powerful and respected figures to assume the position of lay leaders of this organization. The list of leaders during this era of the conference included the cream of the organized Jewish world. People like Rabbi Alexander Schindler, Morris Abram, Kenneth Bialkin, Seymour Reich, all kind of philanthropists like Mortimer Zuckerman, Ronald Lauder, and others. All of them took seriously the idea that the conference had to represent a consensus of pro-Israel opinion. The umbrella group's influence was maintained despite the growing dissent against Israel's measures of self-defense and Israel's refusal to trade more land for the dubious hopes of peace in the aftermath of the failed peace efforts. But in recent years, it's been harder to hold the line against the increasingly loud voices criticizing not just Israel, but criticizing Zionism itself. This problem was illuminated by a bitter debate about J Street's bid for conference membership in 2014. J Street fit most of the criteria of what considered a major Jewish organization. It was founded in 2008 as a Jewish rump of the Democratic Party. J Street was national in scope, had a not insignificant popular following. It had an easier time than did far more established groups in getting mainstream media outlets like the New York Times to provide a platform for its views. And thanks to the generosity of the leftist mega donor George Soros, it had plenty of cash. It billed itself as pro-Israel and pro-peace, but J Street's purpose was an alternative to AIPAC. As such, it sought to serve as the Jewish cheerleader for the Obama administration's strategy of creating more daylight between the United States and Israel. and by 2014 had become the leading Jewish advocate for Obama's policy of appeasement of Iran that led to the disastrous nuclear agreement concluded 1 year later. I'll say more about this because it's a subject that I just began to really understand, even though I was raised in the States and heard these names many times. I'll be back after the break.
Hi, everyone. This is Andrea Simintow from Jerusalem, inviting you to drop everything and join me on my show, Pull Up a Chair. We'll visit this week's quirky stories, meet fabulous guests, and discover my Israel. Together, we'll laugh, shout, and explain the topics that make us say, hey, we've got to talk about that. So get comfortable and pull up a chair with me, Andrea Simintow, every Thursday on Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
You're back with Jay Shapiro, and in the previous segment of the program, I began to share with the listeners my understanding of some of the major Jewish organizations in the United States. I spoke about the Conference of Presidents, and I spoke about AIPAC, and also I said a few words about J Street. J Street's core mission is mobilizing U.S. pressure on Israel to force concessions to the Palestinians. And that's pretty much not what similar to the cause of which organizations like the conference had been dedicated since its founding. So the when it was time came to try to vote J Street into the conference of major Jewish organizations, their membership bid was decisively defeated, with only 17 of the 50 groups voting to back it. So that you have the conference, you have AIPAC, you have J Street. Now there's another major Jewish organization, Hayas. Now, Hayas is interestingly, I knew a lot about it when I was a kid, because it's an old organization. It was founded as far back as 1881, at the start of the massive wave of immigration from Eastern Europe to the United States. The truth of the matter is that the Hayas's lineage is more impressive than that of just about any other Jewish group in America. From its inception in the 19th century throughout the early 1990s, when the last major group of Jewish immigrants arrived on American shores from the former Soviet Union, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, Hayas, had the responsibility of helping masses of largely penniless Jewish immigrants find their way in the New World. Then, interestingly enough, in 2014, the group stopped calling itself by its full name. In an act of political correctness, the group decided to focus on the Hebrew. It wasn't inclusive enough for the 21st century, and now goes only by its acronym, HIAS, H-I-A-S, and goes by the motto, Welcome the Stranger, Protect the Refugee. Now, the shift was as much a matter of the changing face of Hayas' client base and its funding as pretty much as a nod to the contemporary, in other words, it bowed to contemporary liberalism. For the past three decades, almost all of Hayas' clients have not been Jewish. The Hayas of today is the source of legal aid and support for other sorts of immigrants, including Syrian refugees and others seeking to escape either the chaos of the Arab and Muslim world or the misery of Central America. While the focus of Hayas's activism has changed, its overwhelmingly Jewish supporters still think their work is the quintessence of Jewish values. Hayas has never played a role in pro-Israel advocacy, understandable in a way since its mission was a settlement of Jews outside Israel in America. And by the way, I don't know what's happening now, but there are tens of thousands, even millions of refugees. I don't know if they're refugees, they're immigrants, or interlopers. They're coming across the Texas border. It's become a big issue in America and apparently has become a big source of work for Hayas. Now, much of the Jewish community has spent the past 3 years denouncing Trump. They didn't like him. The Jews vote overwhelmingly Democratic, and I saw this in my own family. The very mention of Trump's name gets them all upset. In that sense, Hayas believes that its positions have mainstream Jewish support. So it's interesting. The groups such as the Zionist Organization of America, which strongly supports of the right wing in Israel and supported Trump, and whose president of the ZOA is Morton Klein, was the most outspoken critic of a new nomination to be the head of Hayas because she was too left-wing. According to Klein, Hayas's role in supporting immigration from Muslim countries amounted to an effort to ease the influx into the United States of a population that was likely to be a source of anti-Semitism. By the way, Hayas has also partnered at times with Muslim groups such as the Council on American Islamic Relations that have a record of support for anti-Israel terror and anti-Semitism. So, by the way, in 2017, the CEO of Hayas signed a letter along with other Jewish left-wingers supporting Linda Sarsour, the Palestinian-American activist and a former leader of the anti-Trump Women's March organization. Now, Sarsour has a shameful record of anti-Semitic utterances, opposition to Israel's existence, and ties to Nation of Islam hate-monger Louis Farrakhan. As far as the Zionist Organization of America was concerned, all that rendered anybody who had been associated with Hayas to be a poor choice. It meant that Hayas had ceased to be a Jewish organization in order to be ejected from the conference because it was working to undermine Jewish interests. This is what's happening in the American Jewish organized community as I understand it. As I see it, like the rest of America, Jews are split among partisan lines between Republicans and Democrats. There's little room left for neutrals. While the overwhelming majority of American Jews remain liberals and loyal Democratic voters, a minority that consists largely of Orthodox Jews and political conservatives are backers of the Republican Party, in no small measure because of their record of support for Israel under Trump. Many on the right now regard even AIPAC as unreliable because of its support for the two-state solution and the opposition to the idea of Israel annexation of West Bank settlements. Whether or not that conclusion is reasonable, they see the conference as the last line of defense for a genuinely pro-Israel movement. The Zionist Organization of America's claim that Hayas isn't Jewish is based on the notion that pro-Israel Jews, as opposed to the general Jewish population, are at odds with a growing tendency, even among traditionally nonpartisan organizations like the Anti-Defamation League, to act as either Democratic surrogates or fierce critics of a pro-Israel administration. So that is what's happening, as I understand it, in the American Jewish community. I'm certainly not an expert on the subject, and I grew up in the States. I knew all these acronyms, and I remember supporting these organizations, but they become more and more political over the years. In theory, there ought to be room for compromise between all these organizations so they can all play a constructive role. So the idea that shared history and faith and values can bring all these different groups together under one roof may no longer be true. A group that is comfortable with the likes of Sarsour and other foes of both Israel and of Israel's policy has little in common with Zionists who agree with the Middle East stance of the previous administration and its view of continued mass immigration to the United States. So what began as an effort 70 years ago for Jews to speak with one voice, particularly about Israel, it may mean that the whole idea may not hold up anymore. The mythical concept of Jewish unity may be anachronism. So I hope I haven't bored the listeners with all these little details and names, but I just want to give, as I understand it, the main Jewish organizations, what they stand for, what their history is, and the fact that they may no longer be moving in the same direction, and their goals, which once were always geared pro-Israel, except for Hayas, which was pro-immigration, they may be coming far further apart now, and they no longer can essentially get along with each other. That's how I see it. I may be wrong, but I'm looking at it as objectively as I can. From outside, these names and organizations were well known to me when I lived in the States, and I always thought of them as representative of the Jewish community. This may no longer be true. They might indeed, although they do good work in many areas, may be more representative of the political parties of the members who support them. I'll be back after the
Are you interested in transforming your life, drawing closer to the Creator, and uncovering the deeper meanings and hidden treasures in the Hebrew Bible?
Then join me, Rav Yitzhak Michelson.
And me, William Hall.
On The Science of Kabbalah, where we are seeking to narrow the gap between what we understand of our physical and spiritual worlds. So make sure to tune in every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Israel time, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
Hello, I am Walter Bingham. If you want to hear the news behind the news and the true perspective on world affairs, then the Walter Bingham File is the program for you. We bring you interviews with the movers and shakers, political commentaries, and on-the-spot reports of events as they happen. All here every Tuesday, 4 p.m. Israel time, 9 a.m. Eastern time. And it's all archived on our website. Make it a date.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. On Jerusalem Day, back in May, I attended a rally and dance in front of the main synagogue on Keren Kayemet Street in Jerusalem. This rally generally ends up with a joyous march and dance to the old city in the Western Wall. The people dancing are mostly young people from the various religious schools all over Israel. This year, the celebration was curtailed because of fear of Arab violence. This week was Tisha B'Av, the day commemorating many sad occurrences in Jewish history, including the destruction of the two temples. And the record needs to be set straight. A few hundred Jews ascending the Temple Mount on Tisha B'Av, which is the day commemorating the destruction of the temples that stood on the mount, does not constitute what is being considered now in the Arab world as Jewish settlers storming the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Al-Aqsa Mosque is on the Temple Mount. What it really is Jews wanting to visit their holiest site on a fast day dedicated to remembering the temples that once stood there and their destruction. Prime Minister Naftali Bennett acted judiciously in allowing Jews to ascend the site on last Sunday, despite early violence there in an obvious attempt by some Arabs to prevent Jews from doing so. The Prime Minister's office issued a statement saying that Bennett's directives were that the organized and safe visits by Jews to the Temple Mount should continue while maintaining order at the site. Had he decided otherwise, had he barred Jews from the site, it would have sent a message that just as violence prevented Israel from celebrating Jerusalem Day back in May, as it has been celebrated for years, the scent of violence would prevent it from commemorating Tisha B'Av as it sees fit as well. And this is not a message Israel can afford to send, because then there'll be no end. Jerusalem cannot allow the threat of violence to determine its policies. A reasonable debate can be had regarding whether Israel should adopt a policy of permitting Jews to visit or even pray at the Temple Mount, which is the holiest site in Judaism and the third holiest site of Islam. But once the government determines this is permitted, then the threat of violence should not deter it from carrying out the policies it deems correct. Israel also has the right to expect that a little less than 2,000 Jews going to the Temple Mount not be framed as an assault on the Al-Aqsa Mosque, because when framed in this manner, it ignites passion and invites violence. Those who do frame it in this manner want to do just that. For example, there were big comments by Hamas, which is a terrorist organization. There was a comment from Iran, the Kuwait news agency, the Palestinian Authority, and Turkey's President Erdogan all made comments about Israel's people going up into the old city and going to the Western Wall. All this keep in mind, because some Jews dared to go to the Temple Mount on the fast day commemorated destruction of the temple. While a few Jews who go up to the Temple Mount might be looking for provocation, not all Jews who go there are looking to provoke. And it's the job of the security services to be able to screen out the bad apples and prevent them from causing a disturbance. But to say that any Jew going up on the site on the 9th of Av, Tisha B'Av, is somehow a provocation or a desecration is not something that Israel should have to accept. That this sentiment is shared by Iran, Turkey, Hamas, and the Palestinian Authority is very much to be expected. However, from the perspective of our government, what had to be the most disappointing reaction last Sunday were the responses coming from the United Arab List, which is an Arab party which is part of the coalition. RAM, this party, issued a statement saying that Muslims have an exclusive right to Al-Aqsa Mosque and no one else has any right. In this definition, the Al-Aqsa Mosque is at one part of the Temple Mount, but to consider it being the entire Temple Mount, which is about 144 dunam in size, that is simply wrong. The Ram Party warned worshippers in a statement on Sunday against a large number of settlers who have been storming and violating the sanctity of the Blessed Al-Aqsa Mosque. The party leader, a man named Mansour Abbas, surely knows that settlers, and not every Jew with a knitted skull cap is a settler, they know that the Jews did not storm the site, but rather went up into the site to commemorate the Jewish fast day and to say otherwise other inflames passions. This is not the type of behavior expected from a party which is part of the governing coalition. And Jordan's official news agency, Petra, reported that Jordan's foreign minister issued a statement slamming Israel's continued violation in Al-Aqsa Mosque, the latest of which was today's storming of the holy compound by extremist settlers under Israeli police protection. They love this word, Israeli settlers. They went on to say the Israeli actions against the mosque are rejected and condemned and represent a violation of the historical legal status quo, international law, and Israel's obligation as an occupying power in East Jerusalem. All this was said by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Jordan. Report said that Jordan sent an official letter of protest calling on Israel to stop its violations and provocations and respect the freedom of worshippers. The call for freedom of worship is cited particularly ironic since Jews are strictly forbidden to pray there or even use mouth a biblical verse. Now, Jordan's King Abdullah is scheduled to meet U.S. President Joe Biden in the White House. And he's the first Arab leader to do so, an indication of the importance the Americans attach to the relationship with the Jordanian kingdom. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said as much earlier this month in announcing Abdullah's visit. She said it will be an opportunity to discuss the many challenges facing the Middle East and showcase Jordan's leadership role in promoting peace and stability in the region. That's what she said. Now, it's true. She's right. Jordan does have a role in promoting peace and stability in the region. However, one might question if it fills the role when it joins the likes of Iran, Hamas, and Turkey in turning the visit of little less than 2,000 Jews to the Temple Mount into an attack on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This is really wrong. After Jordan captured the old city back in 1948 and they kicked the Jews out, for a period of 19 years, the city was ruled by Jordan. Of course, they didn't let any Jews go there to the temple site, even though it was part of the ceasefire agreement back in 1948. Jordan broke that ceasefire agreement by not allowing Jews to go to pray. 1967, the old city was recaptured by the Jewish army, the Israeli army, and the defense minister at that time decided to take a very broad approach, and he turned over the keys to the Temple Mount to the Islamic Authority that was in charge. What happened was that the Islamic Authority decided, which is, by the way, under the Jordanian government, they decided that Jews could not go up to the Temple Mount, the most holy place that the Jews know of. And what happened was that Jews were allowed to visit under guard. I have been up to the Temple Mount twice myself, and as you walk around, you are watched by guards who represent the Islamic Authority to make sure that you don't do any praying. They actually watch your lips to see if you're praying. So now what happened was that the Jews went up, and you have all these great dictatorships, if you will, like Turkey and Hamas and all these terrorist organizations taking issue. What is really disappointing is that the Jordanians made a public to do about it, or worse, the Ra'am Party, which is now part of the coalition, came out and really attacked. They issued a statement, and the wording of their statement, I said a moment ago, was that Muslims have an exclusive right, and no one else has any right over it. So essentially Ram warned the worshippers that a large number of settlers are storming the site. Now, they always use the word settlers. They love that word. Anyhow, this is a major problem, I think, because Ram is now part of the governing coalition here in Israel, and taking a position like that means that the government now, our present governing coalition, could be in really deep trouble. So this is how I see it, and we'll have to see how things develop. So until next time, then, this is Jay Shapiro signing off. Thanks for listening. Take care of yourselves.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
If you're hearing this message, everyone else can too. Advertise with Israel News Talk Radio and get your message out to people. We'll build a personalized package for you. Contact advertising at israelnewstalkradio.com.
Straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Hey, this is Jake in Anchorage, Alaska, and I love listening to all the super interesting interviews and up-to-date information on what's happening in Israel.
Hello, this is Anna King, originally from London, now living in Israel. And what can I say? Israel News Talk Radio is my cup of tea.
My name is Bhaskar. I'm from India, and I love listening because you get to know the truth and wonderful voices from this lovely country.
Mom! Okay, wait a minute.
Hi, this is Chava Dax, and I'm calling for the rolling hills of Maale Adumim, just north of Jerusalem. I always listen to Israel News Talk Radio to get all the latest news and commentary and to keep me up to date every day.
This is Sarah Dax from Maale Adumim, and I'm 12. I wish Israel News Talk Radio was boring so my mom wouldn't listen to it all the time. Mom!
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.